Welcome. You're listening to the Media Talk 101 podcast. Media Talk 101 was founded in 2005 as a nonprofit ministry dedicated to teaching media discernment in the light of following Christ. Visit MediaTalk101.org for helpful articles, videos, and other resources. We often mention our award-winning documentary, Captivated, Finding Freedom in a Media Captive Culture, but that's certainly not our only resource. If you have not had the opportunity to attend one of our Media Talk 101 seminars, especially Media Choices, Convictions, or Compromise, you can get that on DVD or through our workbook titled Christianity and Entertainment. I'm your host, Philip Telfer, founder and president. I am glad to be back in the studio maybe not the last time, but at least the last time for a while with co-host, co-worker, and friend Rhett Simpkins. And so I'm going to, on my way to Texas this week, moving my family down there for our ministry transition, but we're going to continue this podcast. Mm-hmm. We'll be recording it remotely. So Rhett will be here in the studio and I'll be down in my office down in New Braunfels, Texas. And so just north of San Antonio. So anyway, it's good to be back here. We weren't sure if we were going to get one more podcast in. So Rhett, anybody ever tell you your brain is plastic?
Well, what is that supposed to mean? I've been called thick-headed before, but never plastic.
Yeah. I'm not trying to offend you, but, you know, your brain is plastic.
Okay.
Yeah, you're thinking, what is he talking about?
Yeah.
Well, that's what we want to talk about. And for you podcast listeners, your brain is plastic, too. And you're like, boy, Philip is just trying to offend everybody. Well, what I'd like to talk about in this podcast today is a subject known as brain plasticity or neuroplasticity. And this is a subject I am very intrigued with. And it was something that I'm somewhat tempted I would love to do a documentary just on the subject of brain plasticity, except I don't think anybody would watch it. It would be tremendously boring. But I did get in our interviews for Captivated, the subject did come up on a couple of occasions. It wasn't something we had kind of toyed with the idea of having a section on brain plasticity. We ended up cutting most of that, although it does get a little bit of an honorable mention. So we're going to play some clips here. Some of them are right off the documentary, and some of them would be from the bonus features, things that didn't make the cut, but a few things from Dr. David Walsh and Maggie Jackson and maybe a few other people. So let's go ahead and play that, Rhett. And
real quick, before we play those clips, I just wanted to add that Dr. David Walsh had a lot of great things to say, but it was just too much to include into a podcast. So I'll include a link in our blog that you can click on to watch the extended interview clips from the bonus features section on the DVD.
Okay, then we'll come back and talk some more about why your brain is plastic.
Okay.
Another important point is that the scientists are beginning to understand how, you know, extraordinarily plastic the brain is. You know, from cradle to grave now, we know that you can grow new neurons, that different parts of the brain will compensate when need be. Someone who's blind will use their visual cortex for auditory purposes. You know, they'll hear better, they'll be more sensitive to sound. So the brain is plastic, and therefore, it's good and bad news. Basically, how you pay attention during the day. If you pay attention in tiny snippets, jumping from something to something like a mad chicken, you're actually training your brain to not be able to focus very long.
One of the basic principles of brain functioning and brain development is captured in a little phrase that the neuroscientists like to use, and that's the phrase, the neurons that fire together wire together. Now, an English translation of that is, whatever the brain does a lot of is what the brain gets good at. And, you know, that's true whether someone is learning how to play tennis, whether someone is learning how to do math, or whether someone is learning, spending hours and hours playing video games.
The American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended for many years now that children under the age of 2 should be discouraged from watching any television.
So in the same study that we found that the more television children watched before the age of three, the shorter their attention spans were later, we also found that the more cognitive stimulation they got before the age of three, and we measured cognitive stimulation by how often you read to your child, how often you take your child to the museum, how often you sing to your child, the kinds of things that many parents think of as being good for babies. We found that the more of those kinds of activities babies had, actually, the less likely they were to have shorter attention spans later in life. So if you think of it, these are really two sides of the same coin. There's certain things we can do early in a baby's life that promote their attention span, and there are certain things we can do early on that hinder it.
There are different attention systems within the brain. We have one attention system deep within the brain, in the limbic brain. I call it the reactive attention system. It is involuntary, hardwired. We don't have to learn it. It is hard. We are hardwired to pay attention to things that move and things that are emotionally stimulating. So that's the one that's working when I'm deeply engrossed in a great mystery. Okay, I'm reading a great mystery, and out of the very corner of my eye, I see a little mouse run along the floorboard. Where would my attention be focused? On that mouse. Okay? It's called the orientation response. We're wired to pay attention to things that move or things that are emotionally stimulating. There's another type of attention. That's the one that we use when we are paying attention to something that isn't moving, something that is emotionally stimulating. For many kids today who have a very, very heavy media diet, what they have is an overdeveloped reactive attention system and an underdeveloped focused attention system. And so we have a growing epidemic of distraction because kids are always responding to all of this technology that is constantly vying for their attention. And a lot of the ways that we used to develop focused attention system have disappeared. One of the things that that is really positive about the brain as God has created is that we can always change. We can always learn new things, and that's captured in that term brain plasticity. And so it's the part that gives us, from a brain point of view, you know, the hope of being able to change. That, you know, as locked in as some habits are, as locked in as some bad learning is, we can always change.
Okay, that's a helpful start for us in just introducing the subject of brain plasticity. Let me read some excerpts on the subject, also known as neural plasticity. So we're talking about the brain. We're talking about neurons, like Dr. David Walsh, you know, the neurons that fire together, wire together. And here's just pulled some of this from Wikipedia, you know, so sometimes a helpful source. Now, it says, during the 20th century, the consensus was that lower brain and neocortical areas were immutable in structure after childhood, meaning learning only happens by changing of connection strength, whereas areas related to memory formation, such as the hippocampus and dentate gyrus, oh my goodness, where new neurons continue to be produced into adulthood, were highly plastic. This belief is being challenged by new findings suggesting all areas of the brain are plastic even after childhood. So plasticity, you know, the changing, new neurons being able to make, or neurons being able to make new connections with one another. And so this is very intriguing. And you might not be intrigued, and so you might want to just turn off this podcast and go listen to some Puffin Fluff somewhere else. But if you really want to, I think this is interesting. So I think you should stay tuned and hear some of the things we have to say about neuroplasticity. Here's some more from Wikipedia. Decades of research have now shown that substantial changes occur in the lowest neocortical processing areas and that these changes can profoundly alter the pattern of neuronal activation in response to experience. I'm not going to read any more of this. You can read this. Look it up on Wikipedia. I like to read this stuff and then try to give it some layman's ideas.
So, yeah, I need that.
So, you know, essentially this, when, as Dr. David Walsh was saying, the baby's brain, you know, when they're a baby's brain is, there's a lot of these connections that are being made in those first few years of life. And for the longest time, the general consensus was that, you know, that is accentuated, hyper-accentuated in those first few years of life, and then it slowly tapers off, all those connections. So by the time you're a young adult, basically you're stuck with what you got, you know? Mm-hmm. Whatever connections are made, that's what you're stuck with the rest of your life. And no, you can't make new connections, and so it's a critical period of time. But because of technology today, because of the ability to do, you know, more brain scanning and brain research, it's still quite an enigma and mysterious part of our body that you know, scientists are still trying to figure out, and I think they'll be spending a lot of long time trying to figure some of these things out. But because of the new technologies that we have today, they're learning more. And one of the things that they're learning is that these neural connections, these new neural connections, actually happen from cradle to grave. Mm. Certainly, it's accentuated in those early years, but it doesn't stop after that. And that's both good news and that's bad news. So that's what we want to talk about. I want to talk about some of the good news and the bad news of neuroplasticity. I'd also like to talk in this episode about some of the other issues regarding attention and things that have to do with our mind, our thinking. And so, you know, let me quote a verse here, Matthew 22:37. It's one that we're familiar with. It says, "You shall love the Lord your God," and it goes, "with all your
heart, soul, mind,"
but also "with all your mind." Mm-hmm. You know, this is, we're to love the Lord our God with all of our mind, as well as these other parts of our life. We live in a culture that is just growing in distractions.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, with these split-screen lives today, media multitasking, I like how my friend Kevin Swanson puts it, the 1,000 exit ramps from the highway of reality. You know, this idea of immediacy, simultaneity. Then we've got the media, the advertising, the entertainment, all vying for our attention all the time. There's constant distractions, media information overload. Now, I wish I had more current statistics on this, but this one's impressive enough, and it goes all the way back to 2006. Maybe even more impressive because it's 2006. In 2006, there were 161 exabytes of new info produced. Isn't that impressive?
I don't even know what an exabyte is.
Yeah, an exabyte. Well, one exabyte is the equivalent of a quintillion bytes. What do you think of that?
Hmm.
Still not tracking? Well, let's put it this way. That's the equivalent of 3 million times the information in every book ever written.
Wow.
That's what I say. And the new information being produced this year will certainly dwarf that.
Hmm.
You know, so think about that. We're just talking about one exabyte. One exabyte is the equivalent of 3 million times the information in every book ever written. And in 2006, there were 161 new exabytes of information, you know, created. And so here in 2013, I'm sure it's over the top. So I don't need to convince anybody that we live in an age of digital distractions. But we do have to think through, how is this affecting us? Now, generally, we talk about that when it comes to morality, when it comes to spirituality, but I also think it needs, you know, when it comes to our attention, when it comes to our how our mind is actually being affected by these things. And this, you know, this is ongoing. I was just telling you, you know, before we started this podcast, so I'll share the story with our podcast listeners, something you are probably familiar with. I was on my way to Indiana to minister for a week at various locations. And I was with a couple of my children in our minivan going down the highway. And then all of a sudden, this car comes up doing about 90 miles an hour, right up onto my tail. But I could see in my rearview mirror, I was like, man, I want to get out of this guy's way because he's in a hurry. But not only was he in a hurry, he can't even stay in his own lane. I could see he's drifting from lane to lane and over the shoulder. And I knew right away, this is some young guy texting probably. Mm. So I got out of his way, he passed me, and sure enough, he was on his phone texting and had no idea that he wasn't even staying in his lane. Well, then I thought, I'm going to be vigilante, you know, I'm going to go honk my horn at him and try to, you know, give some sense of caution and but yet in my minivan he was flying by about 90 miles an hour, and I tried to get up to his speed and I was having a hard time, so I just got as close as I could, laid on my horn, you know. And you know, something similar happened on our trip back, and my concern is not just that they're going to you know, possibly kill themselves, but they, you know, the potential of killing others.
Mm-hmm.
For that foolishness, this distraction. So, but there are things actually going on in the brain, and that's what we're going to talk about. And this goes all the way back to the beginning of electronic media. One of my favorite stories we have in Captivated is the story of the Titanic. So let's listen to that. It has been pointed out that many of the problems we are facing today didn't start with the BlackBerry or the iPod. Let's go back 100 years. On the Titanic's maiden voyage in 1912, she had some of the latest and most powerful communication technology, the wireless telegraph. This new technology not only provided critical communication between ships, it also offered the passengers a new amenity. Imagine being on a cruise ship today with only one cell phone for all the passengers to send or receive a text message. Not only would you have to wait your turn, but the message had to be typed out with only one key. In the 4.5 days until it struck the iceberg, the Titanic's radio operators had sent and received 250 passenger telegrams. On the night of the disaster, Jack Phillips, the senior officer, was feverishly trying to catch up on passenger communications when a message came in from the SS Mesaba, warning of icebergs spotted at specific coordinates. The Mesaba waited for confirmation that the message made it to the bridge. They didn't get a reply from Jack. Instead, he continued to send passenger messages. Second Officer Charles Lightroller had been on duty that night and wrote the following in his autobiography.
The one vital report that came through but which never reached the bridge was from the Mesaba. Phillips was not to know the extreme urgency of the warning, or that we were at the time actually entering the area given by the Mesaba. Phillips explained when I said that I did not recollect any Mesaba report. I just put the message under a paperweight at my elbow until I squared up what I was doing before sending it to the bridge. That delay proved fatal.
It is a sober illustration of the potential distractions that come along with the benefits of technology.
All right, so this culture of distraction hasn't happened overnight,
mm-hmm.
and this has been happening for quite a while. But let me just say a couple more things about brain plasticity before we kind of shift gears and talk about other issues of attention and thinking patterns and issues we're facing today. One of the things when you're talking about, and I'm not a neuroscientist by, you know, of course, and I'm not an expert on this subject. I'm an enthusiast. I'm intrigued. I've read several books that I've mostly enjoyed. I even like to go into one of my favorite stores when I visit Chicago is Marbles, the Brain Store. And it's the whole store is designed around the subject of neural plasticity, that the brain needs to be exercised in order to be functioning at its optimum, you know, and that if the brain's not being exercised, then it gets lazy, you know. And so they have neuroscientists that have worked with them to research just different areas of the brain and what things help strengthen, what kind of activities, fun activities that you can do that can strengthen different parts of how you think. And so the kids love going into Marbles, you know, the Brain Store, because there's a lot of fun hands-on games and things like that that are challenging. You know, it's kind of like a muscle, you know, use it or lose it. And so once again, getting back to layman's terms, one of the subjects that comes up is when we talk about neurons that are firing together, wiring together, we're talking about what they call neural pathways. And the way I would try to help the average person, like myself, process this is, you know, you and I, Rhett, we live out here in rural Illinois presently, at least I do,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be moving, but lived for quite a while in this rural area. And if you were to see a field, you know, of grass or hay, you know, that's not been mowed or baled. You know, you could take a walk through that, and sometimes it can get very, very tall. And you might actually knock some alfalfa down, or if it's a, you know, just a grass field, you could knock some grass down and go from point A to point B in your walk across that field. But, you know, it's really not going to make much of a difference, mm-hmm. you know, in that field if you do that just once. Now, if you were to walk that same path every day, multiple times a day, what's going to happen?
You're going to have a trail.
That's right. And eventually, if you have a really well cut trail now, because you've walked this path, I mean, is it possible to take another route through that field?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you will?
Probably not.
Probably not. And that's, so when you think of neural pathways, and as Dr. David Walsh was saying in that clip earlier, that what the brain does a lot of, the brain gets good at, that when we do things over and over and over again, these are connections that are being made in our thinking patterns, and it becomes what's comfortable. You know, so once again, if a child is spending hours and hours and hours in front of a screen, or they're spending hours and hours and hours playing video games, these are the paths that they are establishing in their thinking patterns, and it's what becomes comfortable. And it's not that they can't do other things with their mind, mm-hmm. Or their time. It's just that has become the path that's been laid down across that field. It's been the track that's been beaten down, and that's why. When children are sometimes forced to change, they find that they can develop new pathways of not only thinking patterns, but that also affects behavior. And that's what happens at Shepherd's Hill Academy. You know, we featured their story in Captivated as well, and that is a 1-year residency program for troubled teens. Many of them that are coming in have behavioral problems. They've got, you know, ADD, ADHD, they're bipolar, they've got all these issues, this big laundry list of problems. And when they get in there, one of the first things they find out that they don't like is that they're not going to have any media or entertainment for the next year mm-hmm. of their life, and they freak out. They're thinking, I'm going to die, you know? I can't live without this stuff. But then when we interviewed them for the documentary, you see that they're loving it, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, because they're forced to walk a different path and to kind of develop some new patterns of thinking. And so that's one of the things. Let me, there's a book that I read. It's actually probably my favorite book on this subject because it was written by a layperson and not a neuroscientist. The neuroscientists, they have some interesting books, but they're a little harder to read.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a book by a man named Nicholas Carr. It's called The Shallows. And this is not a Christian book. And Nicholas Carr, you know, you're going to have to wade through some evolutionary ideas. And I'll explain why that comes up in the book here in a moment. But Nicholas Carr is a journalist. And he became very, very interested in this subject because in the very first chapter he describes, or in the introduction, describes how when he was younger as a writer, He felt like he described himself as a scuba diver diving into the depths of words and ideas and thoughts. And he says, I came to the realization that, you know, years and years later now in this digital is digital immigrant, he says, I'm much more shallow in my thinking. I feel like I'm on a jet ski just skimming the surface all the time and not able to. And I thought, what's going on? Why is my thinking changed? And so that set him on a path to just dog this out and learn. And so he is processing it for lay people. And so it's a very interesting book. Now, why does evolution come up in it? And obviously, we don't believe in evolution or Darwin's ideas or anybody else's ideas of evolution. I believe in the Creator God, you know, who created, as the Bible gives us the account of creation. And so That's the truth. That's the reality. But, you know, we know that in this debate between creation and evolution, you can have a creationist and an evolutionist both go to the Grand Canyon and look at the evidence there. And they're each going to tell you something different. They're going to give their interpretation of that evidence based upon their presuppositions. And so they each have presuppositions. Of course, the creationist presupposes there is a God. Mm-hmm. He has revealed himself to mankind. He has proven himself. He has told us how this all came about. And we look at the evidence and we see it matches, especially things like a worldwide flood. And of course, the evolutionist who starts with the presupposition that there is no God and everything has to happen by naturalistic explanations, then they're kind of stuck. You know, they're going to have a different interpretation of that same evidence. Now, likewise, is these neuroscientists are beginning to discover these changes going on within the brain from cradle to grave. I think that we can each look at that with our presuppositions mm-hmm. and come to different conclusions. Mm-hmm. And of course, the naturalist, the secular humanist, the Darwinist, you know, the evolutionist, they're going to look at this subject of neurons wiring together and fire, you know, that fire together, wire together, and this change going on. Like, wow, look, this is change. This is evolution mm-hmm. in process. And we're seeing the evolution of the brain. You know, of course, I would call it the devolution of the brain, if anything, because I don't think we've gotten smarter. You know, and I'll come back to that in a moment as well. But let me read an excerpt from The Shallows by Nicholas Carr. I've given all the disclaimers. If you want to take the time to read it, I think you'll enjoy it as much as I did. It's one of the few books, by the way, that when I turned the last page, that was the last page, I didn't realize it was the last page. And I was kind of bummed. Usually I'm like, ha, I'm so glad I got finished with this book. I was actually really enjoying the book. And when I turned, I'm like, oh, I'm at the glossary. I'm like, this is over? This is it? Oh, this is such an enjoyable book. But here, he said, experiments show, for instance, that if a person is struck blind, the part of the brain that has been dedicated to processing visual stimuli, the visual cortex, doesn't just go dark. It is quickly taken over by circuits used for audio processing, and if the person learns to read Braille, the visual cortex will be redeployed for processing information delivered through the sense of touch. That's intriguing.
Yeah.
To me, as a creationist, as one who believes in the God, and I believe that God has wired into our DNA, not only the ability for the body to heal, but and for the body to be, for muscles to be stronger or weaker depending on their use, but also some adaptation to environment, and that's something we see. We are not evolving into something else. We started out as humans, and we will always be humans. Just as much as a cat will always be a cat, you know. But we see some variation, you know, within cat kinds and dog kinds. And we have some variation also among humans, you know, mm-hmm. God's special creation. And so when I see this beautiful, this organ we call the brain, that has been designed by God to be able to adapt, you know, and respond to stimulation, to be able to shift and some of its functions when needed. I think that's the evidence, some more evidence of a master planner, mm-hmm. you know, of someone who is much more smarter than we are, you know. And now he goes on another quote from The Shallows by Nicholas Carr. He says, thanks to the ready adaptability of neurons, the senses of hearing and touch can grow sharper to mitigate the effects of the loss of sight. Similar alterations happen in the brains of people who go deaf. The other senses strengthen to help make up for the loss of hearing. The area in the brain that processes peripheral vision, for example, grows larger, enabling them to see what they once would have heard. And so this is fantastic. He quotes a neurologist named Alvaro Pascual Leon. He says, plasticity is the normal ongoing state of the nervous system throughout the lifespan. And another quote from The Shallows, playing a violin, a musical tool, had resulted in substantial physical changes in the brain. This was true even for the musicians who had first taken up their instruments as adults. So now this begins to make sense. I mean, do you play any instruments, Rhett?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, what do you like to play?
Guitar, mostly, lately. Oh,
okay, when you first picked up a guitar, what were you able to just like make some great music?
No.
Okay,
no.
Did it come easy to you?
No.
What was harder, right hand or left hand work?
Probably the left hand, making the chord.
The fingerings,
yeah,
the chords.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like that's not natural. You weren't born doing that kind
yeah.
of stuff. But did it get better?
Yeah.
How did it get better?
I just kept doing it.
Okay. Did you do it a lot then?
Yes.
Okay. So the more you did it,
mm-hmm. the better I got.
And you know what was happening was that, you know, what the brain does a lot of, the brain gets good at.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you forced yourself to make your fingers shape that certain way and hit those certain strings,
mm-hmm.
it's repeated and repeated and repeated. And inside the brain, there are connections being made saying, okay, when I want to do this, this is how I need my body to respond. And this happens on all, you know, whether, you know, when you see, now I do the sport of freestyle, you know, BMX.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done this since high school. And recently I did a show, a freestyle show. I'm 41 years old and people are thinking, can you still do this? And you know what's interesting? It's just like riding a bike. Even if I haven't ridden my bike for a year, I can actually get on my bike and I can do almost most of the tricks I did when I was in high school.
Hmm.
And I don't have to really even think about them anymore because I've done them so many times. It's like I have some neural pathways mm-hmm. that just say, hey, when I'm on this bike and I want to do this particular trick, this is what I need the body to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all being coordinated. And now, there is a change at 41, and that is my stamina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only does the body doesn't necessarily respond to what the brain's telling it to do as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I certainly see a change in. But it does amaze me that I can just get on. It's like they say, like riding a bike. It's kind of locked in there, especially if you've done it so much. And learning an instrument's like that. Well, what they found is that even an adult who begins to learn an instrument or learn another language, it's basically exercising the mind. But on the flip side, one of the most mindless things they say you can do is watch television.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the most passive, mindless things that just, you know, it's like you're putting your brain in a state of comatose, you know. I'm being extreme there, but you know, it's just the opposite of this, the kind of stimuli that needs to happen to strengthen our brains. So, and that's why the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that no child under the age of 2 watch any television,
mm-hmm.
you know, and even over that age, very careful not to have a child exposed to too much television, because this is a hyper time of these connections being made, and it's critical. And so this is so anti, you know, brain development,
mm-hmm.
that they say don't do it. But now that we know that that doesn't stop, this is both the blessing and the curse of brain plasticity, is that because that change, those changes going on inside the brain, they slow down a little bit, but they're going to happen all throughout our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can either be gaining good habits, or we could be actually establishing really, really bad habits. That's right. Let me read one more here from, this is from an excerpt from a book called iBrain by Gary Small, MD. And this is one of those books, probably not as fun to read as The Shallows, and also going to be full of some evolution ideas that you have to kind of wade through and look at some of these things from a different presupposition and a different worldview. But he says, in similar studies to television exposure, Dr. Dimitri Christakis, hey, we know him, don't
mm-hmm.
we? And colleagues at the University of Washington evaluated more than 1,300 children and found that 10% of them had problems with attention. On average, a 1-year-old child spent 2 hours each day watching television, and by age three, the daily average nearly doubled to 3.6 hours. The study showed that by age seven, the more a child watched television each day, the higher risk for a diagnosis of ADHD. This large-scale, longitudinal study definitely confirmed the suspected association between excessive television viewing and ADHD. But experts are not sure what aspect of television viewing may be causing the negative brain effects. One theory is that the rapidity of TV image changes leads to sudden shifting among multiple neuronal circuits. When this occurs over an extended time in a young developing brain, the normal laying down of neuronal pathways is disrupted, which may lead to impaired attention abilities. And so, you know, and then it goes on. He goes on to quote what I just mentioned, that the American Academy of Pediatrics, therefore, has said, you know, no child should be watching television under the age of two. Now, boy, we're running out of time. And I have, like I said, I'm so intrigued by this, and you might be bored silly. But so if you're super bored, I'm going to give you an exit ramp real soon. And we're going to wrap this up for today. But I think I'd like to keep rambling on a little more on this subject. So I think we'll stretch it into a second podcast while we're sitting here together. We do pre-record these. And so, especially since I'm moving down to Texas, it's going to be helpful to have a couple lined up while we kind of make the transition before we get back to it. So if you're interested in this subject, well, then stay tuned, you know, and you can, in next week, we'll keep going. Or if you have a question, you can certainly ask it, and I won't get it before we record the next one, because we're just going to push pause and push record again and keep going today. But certainly don't hesitate to send us your questions or comments to podcast@mediatalk101.org. And then, you know, the next time we get around to recording a podcast, we'll address your question then. We always give priorities to our podcast listeners. Let me close at least this week's podcast with a couple quotes. One from Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman, and then one from a great evangelist, A.W. Tozer. We'll start with Neil Postman. He says, "To be unaware that a technology comes equipped with a program for social change, to maintain that technology is neutral, to make the assumption that technology is always a friend to culture, at this late hour, is stupidity, plain and simple." So let me finish up with a quote by A.W. Tozer, and he was commenting on this psalm that says, "Commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still." And he says, "Is a wise and healing counsel, but how can it be followed in this day of the newspaper, the telephone, the radio, and the television? These modern playthings like pet tiger cubs have grown so large and dangerous that they threaten to devour us all." And that was written in the 1950s. And he couldn't have imagined what it was going to look like in our day and age. But all of these things have become like pet tiger cubs. You know, they're so cute and cuddly, we think. We bring them in. We don't realize how destructive they can be. Now, I'm not saying, once again, I give this disclaimer all the time when I speak to groups. I'm not anti-media. I'm not anti-technology. But I don't believe it's always good, and I don't believe it's always bad. But we have to be careful, because there are a lot of things, in this case, in this week's subject, changing the way we even think. And that is something not only am I concerned about, but I believe God's concerned about.
You've been listening to the MediaTalk 101 podcast. Visit MediaTalk101.org for helpful articles, videos, and other resources. Click on the audio tab to get a free download of Philip's audiobook, "What Wouldn't Jesus Do? Media Choices in the Light of Following Christ." And if you haven't seen our award-winning documentary, Captivated, Finding Freedom in a Media Captive Culture, be sure to order your copy today. Parents Television Council calls it deft and powerful, and numerous moms, dads, and pastors say it's a must-watch for every Christian family and church. If you have a question or a topic you would like to have discussed on this program, please send an email to podcast@mediatalk101.org.